Good evening. This is the Health Commission meeting, February 4th. Welcome, everybody in the audience. It's nice to see so many people here tonight. The first order of business will be the approval of the minutes of the December meeting. There was no meeting in January. Are there any corrections or additions to the minutes as published? Okay, there being no corrections, I'll look for a motion to approve the minutes. Second. And I presume there'll be no objections to that. All right, so the minutes are approved. Next is the public comment period, and at this time, anybody who wishes to speak on a subject that is not on the agenda may come forward, and you have 3 minutes to speak. So when you do come forward, please identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Enns and members of the Commission. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I'd like to read something from the minutes of last December's meeting. It's from Dr. Thomas. It's his wish list of top 7 things he would like to see. Number 1, putting more effort and funding into primary prevention. 2, realization that economics, minimum wage, is highly associated with health status. If minimum wage doesn't pay for basic food and shelter, there will be homelessness, desperation, malnutrition, and disease. Number 3, fluoridation of water. Number 4, universal health care. In parenthesis, majority of bankruptcies are due to large medical debt. Number 5, outpatient detox center. 6, program for the medically fragile homeless. And 7, labeling of GMO foods. And I saw Dr. Pinkel, former member of this commission, on Saturday, and he said he also supported Dr. Thomas's wish list of 7. And I'm here to say that I support it. And I'd like to ask the commission to check with Dr. Thomas and see if he would like this list of seven sent to the Board of Supervisors as a recommendation as is, or if he'd like to provide any backup for each item. And I know with the talent we have on the commission, there could be added input from the commission. But I hope this will be taken up as an action item, the whole package of 7, and sent on as a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Arnold. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment at this time?
Good evening, Honorable Eanes and members of the Commission. My name is Andy Lujan, and I'm proposing a project currently in Atascadero of implementing a substance abuse treatment center with the components of detoxification and a 36-bed recovery program nestled there on 2.5 acres, and I just wanted to announce it to you all that we're very interested and excited about the networking we have begun here in the community with Atascadero. We're very grateful to be accepted in the community there by numerous individuals. We just want to share with you that we are aware and appraised of the economy, but we do want to do our part. We're very supportive of the public entities and the need to help nonprofits, and we're here to just share our support and to announce that we will have a medical director on board, nurses, 24-hour staff, clinical directors, and I think you will be very proud addition to the community here. I want to thank you.
Thank you. Could you say again the name of your organization?
The name of the program is Alto Oaks Recovery Center.
Okay. And that's going to be located in Atascadero?
In Atascadero on Front Street.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to make a public comment?
I'm here with Andy Lujan. My name is Jackie Sims-Phil J. I've worked in the alcohol and drug community for over 30 years, and I know I don't look like it. But my experience has been very positive. I can't tell you how much it has meant to me to be able to continue for the years that I have worked in this field, to continue working and still feel young and still feel excited and enthusiastic about what we do. I know that our services will enhance whatever programs are going on here. We'll be able to provide what some of the community agencies will not be able to provide. We'll be able to work with oftentimes people that are working that are struggling with their families, or their families are struggling with them. We've addressed people that have issues with the criminal justice system, people that have comorbid or coexisting illnesses, and we've worked with the general populations. I've also been an employee assistance professional and have worked with various companies in dealing with troubled employees, and I know that for every dollar spent, it has been proven, companies save up to $7 for every dollar spent on helping employees with problems. So we'll bring a range of support, a range of opportunities and experience, and we're really looking forward to being here. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anybody else? Okay. Then the public comment period is now closed, and we'll move forward to the first item on our agenda. I'm sorry, Commissioner Hetherington?
I like Jesse's idea about taking Dr. Thomas's recommendations and sending them to the Board of Supervisors. How would we go about doing that?
As he was saying that, I figured I didn't really have any idea how we would do that. So I was going to think about how we might do that between now and next month. So did you have some idea, Mr. Arnold? Did you have some? I don't really know what the process would be.
Well, obviously something public comment you can't act on now, but you can decide to agendize it at your next meeting and discuss it. I would suggest, since most of them call for legislation, hopefully Commissioner Shimousis would spearhead it. Those that don't, there's someone here that knows something about every one of these items. And as I say, if Dr. Thomas says go for it, and whether he gives you some more input or not, at your next meeting you can decide to send it on, or take the next month to get the added input you need from Dr. Thomas or other people on your panel and send it on. To me, it's that simple. That's what you're here for. This is things that Dr. Thomas wants, and I think most consumers, people in the community want, and it's our duty to send this recommendation on to the board. Thank you.
Okay. I will have an opportunity, I hope, to talk with Dr. Thomas, and we'll see where we go from there. Okay. We'll have something to say about it next month.
Okay, so it'll be on the agenda.
Yeah, we can agendize it for next month. Okay, now, let's see, where were we? Oh, okay, we were moving on to the Hep Seed Project. David Kilbourn is here from the Slow Hep Seed Project at AIDS Support Network. You don't look like David Kilbourn.
He will be here shortly.
okay, I mean, we could, if he's wanting to be the presenter here, we could maybe go on with the agenda. And
we're actually sharing the
sharing
presentation.
It?
So
okay.
I'm Edie Conan. I'm the executive director of AIDS Support Network and Slow Hep C Project. And we have a PowerPoint that...
Oh, great.
There we go.
Oh, thank you, Edie.
Yeah. So we're here today to talk about the history and accomplishments of the Slow Hep C Project and tell you about the current direction it's taking and to let you know why the project is continuing to need our community support. And for those who may not know, Hep C is a communicable blood-borne disease. So if you want to go to the next slide. Communicable blood-borne disease that affects the liver. And most people who contract the disease are unaware of its presence for anywhere from 10 to 20 years after their infection. And the disease causes progressive liver damage and, if left undiagnosed, can lead to end-stage liver disease. Chronic and unchecked Hep C is the primary cause of liver transplants in the U.S. And as you can see on the slide, approximately 4 million people in the United States are infected. 650 Californians are infected, 650,000 Californians are infected, and over 4,000 cases have been reported in our county as of December 2006. There is a treatment, and for those patients who choose to go through it, it's costly, lengthy, and difficult. It's a regimen of interferon and ribavirin, and it causes side effects that are much like chemotherapy, as well as causing severe depression in some patients. And many patients can't tolerate the regime, and many rebound after initial success with the regime. So basically, they'll go for several months having no viral load, and then suddenly the virus will rebound in their systems. And this slide talks about the cost of Hep C. And the cost of Hep C treatment is expensive. It's $25,000. But if you compare that to the cost of hospitalization for end-stage liver disease, which can go anywhere from $31,000 to into the $100,000 mark, or the cost of a liver transplant, which is over $300,000, we're looking at a savings by treating patients, catching them early, and preventive care for them. So on to the next slide. As a short history, the Hep C Task Force was called together in 1999 and met for almost 2 years prior to the official creation of the Slow Hep C Project. And the task force was comprised of representatives from public health, drug and alcohol services, veterans services, the AIDS program from public health, the AIDS Support Network, CHCCC, CMC, Cal Poly, EOC, and North County Connection, all of whom had concerns about this growing health problem, many of whom were seeing the rising numbers of clients in their own communities that were diagnosed with Hep C. With the support of the Community Health Foundation, the task force created a website, hosted several physicians' forums, and a formal preceptorship, training local physicians, and that was given by a Stanford hepatologist. We expanded the Hep C support groups in the county and created a needs assessment for those living with Hep C to gauge the feasibility of creating a program that was specifically targeted to this population. As we thought, the needs voiced by the people with Hep C were enormous. And why did we choose ASN to be sort of the umbrella agency? Well, the task force decided to create a service plan, and they recognized the efficiency of modeling it after a program with existing and successful programs that incorporated the elements from the AIDS Support Network's early intervention and social services programs. And ASN became the lead agency because of our experience with similarly marginalized populations and our ability to educate the community about a stigmatized disease, our visibility, and our history in the county. So in July 2001, we received a 3-year grant from the California Endowment, and we were able to provide program services to HCV-positive people in our county. At the end of that year, our staff and program were in place, and we were able to open our doors for services. The California Endowment framework allowed us to hire a health counselor and a benefits counselor, a volunteer coordinator in partnership with AmeriCorps. And through the grant and with the help of the health department, our county provided testing for high-risk populations, both at clinics and through their outreach van. And through partnerships with EOC and Planned Parenthood, Drug and Alcohol Services, and others, we were able to fold HCV prevention messages in with HIV prevention programs. Additionally, we were able to have staff speak to groups all around the county, from Cal Poly classes to Rotarians, about Hep C and our programs, and did outreach to physicians to acquaint them with our services, and also held a hepatitis C symposium to inform providers about latest treatment modalities and other concerns of people living with Hep C. So our initial goal was to serve 200 people through this grant by the end of 3 years. we reached our goal of 200 people within the first year that we had our doors open. So some of our client services include health education and physician referral. With the California Endowment Grant, we were able to fund clients' biopsies, some lab work, some medical exams. Our health educator accompanies clients to physicians, and you'll note that it says no local physicians initiating treatment, and we still are facing that problem. So we have physicians and specialists who are coming in from out of our county, from Stanford and San Francisco, who come once a month, and we connect with those physicians. We also have the benefits counselor who helps determine eligibility and connects people with insurance programs to enable them to get medical assistance. We had funding for mental health counseling, which was helpful for our clients because of the depression factor with the drug regime. We also had some money for transportation assistance to get people to their doctors. We also provided a lot of services for transportation through our volunteer services. We also had a food pantry and continued our support groups. So as you can see with our client snapshot, most of the clients that we're seeing are between the ages of 25 and 64. Most are fairly far along in their disease process in that they've had the virus for a long time before they come to our doors. 60% male, 40% female. And what we're seeing is 50% of people who come to us at intake who are below the federal poverty level. We're also seeing 25% of those people at intake with no insurance. And a lot of our clients are struggling with drug and alcohol issues and mental health issues when they come in the door. That's even before they start any medication process that might kick people even farther over into the depression area of mental health issues. We see a high instance of homelessness. 24% of our clients on intake are homeless. And we see a lot of people who are co-infected. We have people with HIV, people with diabetes, heart disease, and pretty much anything else that comes along the pipe. So just a little bit about the successes that we've had in our program. Once again, we've met our 200 very easily in the first year, and now we have enrolled over these last few years 560 clients for services. Out of that, we've connected 85% to medical care. We've linked, and of those 85%, 25% have qualified for or chosen to go on treatment. Some people choose not to go on treatment and manage their disease through lifestyle change. About 60% of our clients have been linked to the appropriate benefits programs because they had no benefits at intake, and some of our clients are still struggling with the benefits problems. They're ineligible for certain benefits. Education and outreach, we've done, as I said, education and outreach to a variety of groups throughout the county. And one of the biggest groups that we try to educate are the physicians, so that they're not hesitant to initiate treatment. And so one of the things that we did in our first few years was have a large physician symposium. So these are some numbers about the contacts and numbers of meals that we provided. Obviously, there's been a lot of activity in our office. We've had over 5,000 contacts for health and benefits counseling. We've provided 81,000 meals for clients. And along with our ASN clients, the food pantry is usually our most utilized resource because we have so many low-income clients. We also offer nutritional counseling through some Cal Poly interns, and we were able to offer some of that to our Hep C clients. And with the California endowment dollars, we were able to fund over 400 lab work and medical appointments. We've also started, in partnership with CHC, a vaccination program for Hep A and B, and that's targeted for our Hep C clients and for young gay men in particular. And we also have started a Hep C support group at CMC. So, and I'd just like to applaud our county for their awareness of this problem. They've been a great support to us, especially since we've run through our three-year funding cycle from the California Endowment. We've received funding from the Preventive Health Grants, which are sort of sustaining our programs right now, funding through the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation, through United Way, and we have tremendous support from our public health department. They continue to test high-risk people out in the community, even though there is no more money coming to them to do that through the California Endowment. And also applauding our county for going ahead with syringe exchange, because a lot of our clients come to us having utilized and shared needles. So the syringe exchange program is obviously a huge factor in staving off future infection for Hep C. So our county truly outpaces a lot of state and program funding, especially, and just awareness, I think. So we still have a lot of challenges for our Hep C program. We're still pretty low on the radar for the public's knowledge and for policymakers to enable funding to come through, like on a state level or on a national level. We still have the problem of no local physicians who are initiating treatment. We have local physicians who will follow a client once they have initiated treatment and treat side effects, but nobody will take that first step and say, okay, let's sign you up for treatment and let's get going. So we still have to depend on out-of-county physicians and specialists to do that. We have limited resources because of that lapse in the California endowment grant cycle. And so we've had to scale back staff time and services to some extent. We've been fairly creative, and we can still do our health counseling and benefits counseling. We still can connect people to resources in the community, but we can't pay for as many resources as we used to. One of the things that's coming up that I think is going to be challenging for us as an agency and for a lot of people in the community is the possibility of an early prison release. There's a huge number of people in prison who are HCV infected, and that could have an impact on all of our counties. Once again, Hep C is underreported by physicians, and when we had more staff time, we were helping the physicians report. We were doing the CMRs for physicians. We don't have the time or manpower to do that anymore, so it's something that from our end, we're seeing as still an underreported disease. And because we have much more limited resources, the availability of screenings is only to the very highest risk categories. So the health department is only screening IV drug users at the moment. So those are some of our challenges. And this is a chart that shows you that when we were funding those screenings, you could see in 2001, 2002, 2003, we saw a huge spike in numbers of cases reporting. We were also helping with the reporting at that time, and we saw not only the partnership between us helping with reporting, but the ability of the health department to test a lot more people. We saw quite a few more people being diagnosed and reported. So, and I'm going to toss it now to David Kilburn, who's going to talk about the California Hepatitis Alliance.
Thank you. I think you'll see, my name is David Kilburn. I'm the coordinator of finance for the AIDS Support Network and Slow Hep C Project. You'll see here there's a sheet that's talking about a Hep C State Advocacy Day. What's really exciting is because of the successes of our program in San Luis, we have been invited to serve as founding steering committee members of a newly formed state advocacy group called the California Hepatitis Alliance. And the representatives on so far that are serving on the steering committee are, director of hepatology for UC Irvine Medical Center, myself from here in San Luis, the AIDS coordinator for the City of Los Angeles, medical director for Oasis Clinic in Oakland, which is a rehab and detox facility, the American Liver Foundation, and the list goes on. It's really exciting. We're newly formed the group, and part of the plan is what the Hep C Alliance is committed to do is providing culturally competent public education and awareness of Hep C, and to focus on sound public health policy and advocacy to improve California's public health approach to liver wellness. So part of what we're doing right now is we're forming five regional advocacy teams throughout the state. Northern California, Southern California, with Central California, and then there's more way rural, northern, and down in Riverside area. We're trying to form advocacy teams in those areas to have a shared common voice on changing public policy. We're just getting started, and our first event that we're doing is this Advocacy Day on March 12th. And this, we're funded through this, from another California endowment grant. So we are actually able to pay for advocates to go and do our advocacy in Sacramento. So I just, if anyone is interested, there's going to be a lot of activity starting with trying to raise awareness and make some changes in public policy. We understand this is a very interesting time to be looking for legislation that might cost some dollars, but we're trying to educate our decision makers now, because there's a huge lapse in knowledge, I would say. People really don't understand the difference in hepatitis A, B, and C, for example. So we're going to start right now. We're building on the strengths that we've already built on in San Luis here. So hopefully you'll be seeing lots of activity and raising awareness of Hep C. So I thank you for listening to us. And if you are interested in getting more information, our contact information is here, and we can get you on our mailing list for any actions that we're doing locally. So thank you.
Thank you both very much for that. That's a very interesting presentation. Would anybody in the public care to comment? Okay. Again, thank you for being here. We appreciate your taking the time. Now we're going to move on to the main presentation for this evening on the county detox treatment services, and I'd like to defer to Commissioner Warren to introduce this program.
Provide more services for San Luis Obispo County for detox. And I'd like to introduce Star Graber, who's pulled a panel of folks here together to let us know what's happening.
Good evening. This on? Okay, that one's on. Good. My name is Star Graber, and I'm with the Division of Drug and Alcohol Services under Behavioral Health. And I was here in December, and I gave you a copy of a report that was titled Report and Plan for Addressing Detoxification Needs for Substance Abuse Users. And I wanted to point out, I do have copies of that report up here if folks would like that. And it's also available on the website. And the website will be on your screen here. Tonight, what I'm going to do is give you a quick summary of the report because, of course, you have it and you can read it. And then I have a couple of speakers so that you can hear, and you have a new one-page handout for tonight regarding the current status of where we are and where we're going. Jean? Thanks. One more. So detoxification defined, it's a set of interventions aimed at managing acute intoxication and withdrawal from substances. It usually includes medications to manage the symptoms, but it is not treatment. This is usually considered the front end of treatment, and it is to prevent potentially life-threatening complications. There are three purposes in detoxification, and one is to evaluate the patient or the client, and then stabilize their withdrawal symptoms, and then eventually to foster them into treatment. And so that's an important part of detoxification. In the paper, doing research, the estimated need for our county, the prevalence for withdrawal rates in the general population is 5%. For those clients in substance abuse treatment, the service demand for detoxification is about 2% of the clients. So at this point, what we believe is that there's an estimated need for detoxification services for San Luis Obispo somewhere between 120 individuals and 300 individuals per year. Other counties, we did take a look at that in the report to see what medium-sized counties, what they had available in way of number of beds and detoxification slots. And what we found out was the population in other counties was about 3 beds per population of 100,000. That means that our county would need 7 to 8 detoxification beds. And that also matches up with the 300 people that I mentioned before. So we're right in track if you were to track out the number of days that the people stay and so forth. It's about 300 people. We need at least 7 or 8 beds in the county. There are different types of detoxification, and they're covered in the paper. Outpatient detoxification is where the client can come to a clinic or a facility on an outpatient basis, meaning they live at home, and then come to the center for their medications and their symptom management. The cost of that, we're estimating, is about $92 per patient, per person, per day, but that does include the medication costs. If you look at social model residential detoxifications, and this is where a person goes to a facility. In a lot of ways, it's not a medical facility, but rather a social model, meaning the staff are trained to watch and you have 24-hour care in those facilities. The cost for that would be about $61 per bed per day, but that does not include the medications that are needed to help the person through their withdrawal and their detoxification. Medical detoxification is hospital-based and, of course, is very expensive. The average cost for that is about $1,200 per day per bed. Now, the pros and cons of the three different types of detoxification. As I mentioned, with outpatient detoxification, the person can live at home so that they can do their life, in other words, go to work, work with their families, that kind of thing. Outpatient detoxification is not dependent upon the number of beds. Often what happens is you get a number of beds, they get full, then the next person can't go in. With outpatient detoxification, that's not the problem. It is effective for low to moderate detox situations. However, the cons are that the client fears that they can't do it unless they go in because they're not in a safe and kind of contained environment.
And it's not appropriate for all cases. And you do still need supervision. So the client must be able to come to the facility on a daily basis to be seen and checked out and so forth. Social model detoxification, the pros to that is that there is 24-hour observation. They're in a safe, controlled environment, usually away from their drugs and using friends and folks. It is a quiet and supportive environment. However, the cons are that it's bed-dependent, meaning you only have so many beds. When their beds are full, then the person has to wait until the next bed becomes available. The person does have to leave their environment. And so what that may mean for some folks is it may mean that they temporarily lose any housing. They may not be able to work during that time while they're in the social model detox. Medication, of course, as I mentioned, the con is that it's the most expensive form of detoxification and requires a lot of staffing. You do have doctors, nurses, 24-hour care. It is a true medical facility. Most detoxifications under medical are really reserved for the most high risk. Those with life-threatening seizures, clients who may become suicidal or homicidal, and those clients who are pregnant. Really, that's the level of care. Now, there are cost savings, and of course, most of the cost savings by having a detoxification facility or program would be that there's cost savings to hospital ER rooms, because right now that's what's happening. There's cost savings to jail and crime, and there's also cost savings to the psychiatric hospital or the PUF unit, because that's where the clients currently are going. Of course, there's no immediate cost savings, and the hospitals and so forth are private facilities, and so there's not a one-to-one ratio that you could say, okay, take the money from here and put it here. That would be difficult. Currently, as you know, we currently have one bed up and running for detoxification, and that is with Ocean View Rehabilitation. It is a private for-profit, but I want to, and I put up on the screen the phone number there, because it is available for the citizens of our county, and but we have a lot of things in the works. One of the things, and I'd like to introduce our nurse practitioner, whose name is Katie Dolezal, probably very familiar to a lot of you. Drug and Alcohol Services with the county has just started an outpatient detox pilot program. Just is starting basically as we speak. There's three parts to this program. There's the methamphetamine medical support. There's going to be alcohol detoxification. And then there is the opiate piece. Now, the opiate detoxification will not probably come on board until March. But at this point, we are prepared to take clients for outpatient detoxification for alcohol and methamphetamine. This pilot project is only for 6 months, and it is funded with Proposition 36 dollars and drug court dollars, so it is limited at this time to those populations. Why is it important to do a pilot project for outpatient detox? One of the things, if you look at the research, the outcomes between social model residential and outpatient detox are very similar. The costs are very similar, and the outcomes long term are also very similar. One of the things I wanted to check out is, in our community, what does that look like? Now, previously we had an outpatient detox, and Katie could tell you a little bit about that. It hasn't been going on for about 5 years, and so we want to update our experience. And some of the outcomes that we can expect to measure are, what are the numbers of participants? So again, we're kind of checking that 300 number to see if it's accurate. What are the types of detoxes that are coming forward? What are the primary drugs of choice? What is our success rate? Simply pass, fail, to see if it's effective outpatient detox. What is the cost? We'll be able to measure that per client. Just check out some figures. And then what is our follow-up rate in the treatment? So we're going to be measuring all of those outcomes during this 6 months. And what I plan to do then is publish a subsequent report in the fall about this pilot project so that we can verify some of the numbers and see the effectiveness of outpatient detox. Now, what's happening with social model detox? Because some communities have both. As I said, one's dependent upon beds and one's not, and different pros and cons. So a lot of communities have both types of detox. The other thing, too, a lot of the national data is showing a movement towards outpatient detox. However, almost all, up to 90% of the detoxes are currently happening in social model facilities. So a couple things are happening there. I talked about Ocean View Rehab, which is a private, for-profit facility, and currently they have one bed. They are up and going. They are licensed and certified as a treatment facility. Project Amend, and I'm going to have Michael Axelrod come up and speak in a few minutes, is a private nonprofit facility, and they're in the process of getting certified and licensed and converting to a residential treatment, and will include four beds. So things are happening there. Their program is for men. Good Samaritan has been collaborating with the North County Homeless Services, and they're hoping to put a six-bed social model detox facility as part of the North County Homeless Shelter that's going to be planning there. But again, they're currently fundraising. Probably the timeline for that is a couple years, 2 years out. And then you just heard about the new project that I just heard about, too, potential in Atascadero, private for-profit, and it will include detoxification beds and also residential treatment, and they're currently in the permitting process. So there is quite a bit going on. There's also private providers or private physicians who now in their offices can do outpatient detox for opiates. And so that's relatively new. Most in the past, you've had to do opiate detox through the methadone clinic and so forth, which is still in existence. But now private physicians can do that. And we're in the process, and Katie certainly has been spearheading this, about getting more and more physicians and working together on that to increase the knowledge in this area. And lastly, I wanted to tell you that Drug and Alcohol Services, we've been collaborating and working, and we have secured a facility through the Housing Authority. I'm going to ask Carol Hatley to come up and talk to you in a minute, as well as Biz Steinberg, about our collaboration. Currently, the housing will be used for transitional living, but should operating funding come available, and again, in the report, it's listed there, anticipated to be, because you have to have 24-hour staffing, to be about $180,000 for an 8-bed facility. This facility currently is going to be for transitional housing, but it could be converted to social model detox, and at some point it would be 4 beds for women probably. The difficulty is you have men, women, North County, South County, San Luis, and so forth. And so part of the decision has been to really have smaller facilities kind of embedded in the communities so that folks don't have to leave their house so much and that kind of thing. So I'm going to call on Biz Steinberg to come up and talk a little bit about our collaboration and a little bit about that, and then Carol Hatley, and then Michael Axelrod.
Good evening, Chairman. Can you hear me? Chairman Ann and all the commissioners. First of all, I need to thank you for putting your time in and serving on the Health Commission. I was one of those people a long time ago that thought that might be a good idea, so I really applaud your service to the county and to our community. My name is Biz Steinberg. I do work at EOC, and have been really privileged to be part of this collaboration of learning. I have learned so much from Star as she was looking at the national and state statistics and then bringing it home to our local area. Also, Susan has been so involved for years. So I'm really here to just express my appreciation, my organization's appreciation of the efforts made to figure this out. It's a challenging situation. None of us have lots of money. And I think a few of STAR's last comments are so appropriate. As the folks that I serve every day, whether they're the homeless families or the homeless vets or some of our Head Start families who need to be close to their own family and community for support, but they have challenges to deal with detoxification, I would just encourage whatever efforts the Health Commission can support our drug and alcohol services programs and the advice that STAR has shared with all of us to keep building on both that outpatient and social model, working with local nonprofits and continue to build the capacity. I think when you hear from Project Amend, and of course I serve on the Housing Authority Board and the Community Health Center Board, people need medical homes, and you all know that better than most of us because you study it all the time. So the fact that our community health centers can potentially be a future medical home once people get through this process. You know, detox is the first part, is what I've learned. And then there's all this aftercare and support so that people can really achieve their goals and be back with families and have the support of their families. So these smaller facilities that STAR has just highlighted certainly enhance the collaboration, stretch the dollars, and then bring the collaborative services that these individuals and families need to one place. Serving on the Housing Authority Board, I learned real quick from a woman named Ruth Worship, who was a member of the League of Women Voters and helped start the Housing Authority. Low-income housing needs to be peppered through a community, not like they did in Chicago with Cabrini Green, those giant buildings. I kind of have the same philosophy here, that we're a widespread county. We cover a lot of square miles. So however we can put these smaller projects, build on small, these two of them apartments or Project Amend, Life Steps, Griffin House, a new program I didn't know about in Atascadero, supporting Good Samaritan and the future development of homeless services here in our community. I just really applaud STAR, Dr. Graber, and the Drug and Alcohol Services for bringing this to you, that you want to hear about it, and that you will be able to help us work with the Board of Supervisors, because that I see Mr. Gibson in the auditorium, and the supervisors actually prioritized this last year as one of their major goals over time. And I know we have tough times right now, but as STAR showed with the what costs there are per day, it seems to me the 61 and 92, we can really help a lot of folks get to their goals, help our community, and get back into being self-sufficient and helping us in other areas. So I appreciate the time to speak, and I apologize for having to leave for the next thing now. Thank you, STAR, and thank the commission.
Okay. Carol Hatley.
Faster. Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity as well. And I have to reiterate what Biz said. Carol Hatley from the Housing Authority. And we, the Housing Authority, have collaborated with EOC, Transitions Mental Health, AIDS Support Network, many of the agencies providing services to the same clients that we try to house. When this came up with a social model detox criteria and the need for it in our area, I have to admit that if it wasn't for STAR educating us on what the needs were, what worked best, it was wonderful to have STAR to be there. And so we then, the Housing Authority, looked at what we could do to help provide that housing that is so needed, which is, of course, expensive and difficult to find, and Project Amend will attest to some of those things as well. But we figured at that point we refer a lot of our clients to drug and alcohol and mental health, so we certainly wanted to be a collaborative member of this, as is Transitions and EOC and all of the programs that we offer. The Housing Authority, of course, has public housing units in the city of San Luis Obispo, and we operate the Section 8 program countywide. So I looked at a project that we have, which is unusual in nature because we actually acquired this existing project. It's a three-unit complex, two bedrooms each on Upham Street. Right now, it sits back. Nobody really even knows that it's a, quote, public housing project because it is so unusual. So we felt that this was a good location to first offer to see if it would meet the social model needs. In collaboration with the other efforts going on in the county. So we're going to start with the couple of units then that Star has mentioned so that we can offer that at a reasonable price. We obviously have the luxury of owning that project outright, and with the HUD funding that we get, that way we can provide the housing for Star, they can provide the services, and that social model detox is meeting the needs of the community that is difficult to meet in this area due to the housing costs. So we really feel fortunate to be able to offer that. I think it's a good location. It has a lot of potential to work within the community and in an area where really it can be utilized to its maximum potential, and nobody will even really know that it's there. I know Project Amend, who is speaking next, has a location that has worked well for them. And really, if this helps meet the need on the social model detox, we are happy to be involved. And again, I just have to congratulate everybody and Star on the information that she provided us to make this become a reality. Yes.
The question is to who your consumers are going to be for this particular project?
Actually, they'll all come from drug and alcohol. This will be, we will lease the project to them, and then they will fill the three units with the social model beds, four beds with the one unit then being utilized for staff.
At this point, the facility will start as transitional housing because there's not the ongoing funding for the 24-hour staffing, so we're going to start with transitional housing. Because another piece of this, as Biz was saying too, you have detox, but then where do they go after they leave, you know, in 5 days, 14 days, and then where do they go, and then where do they go? At this point, we're starting with this facility as a transitional housing, meaning after sober living, after residential treatment. So at the very end of the housing piece, we're going to start there. Because there is no ongoing funding for the 24-hour care, and it does take approximately at least three months to get licensed as a social model detox, we're waiting to see how that unfolds. But at this point, we're very lucky to have this transitional housing. We're going to start with it like that and then see where the rest of the community and the funding unfolds. And then we can convert it if we're still needing four beds. For more beds of social model detox, or if in fact we need the housing as well. But it's clients at this point who will come out of sober living and out of residential folks. Yeah. So it's there and available, and one of the biggest hurdles, of course, to starting a social model detox is the facility. And so it will be there, and it will be contained for us.
I have a question. So if you go to the highest level acute care, when somebody transitions out of that, then where does that go? Does that fall into this transitional housing, or?
Normally what happens after a residential detox placement is that they need to go to treatment, residential treatment. And so a Project Amend, for example, will tell you about how they're going to have detox and residential treatment right in the same facility so that the folks can transition easily. And then once they finish with the treatment, then would be housing. So detox, treatment, housing.
So currently what's occurring with hospitalized folks.
Well, what's happening with those folks currently, a lot of different situations. One is they end up at the homeless shelter. Sometimes they end up at the jail, and or at the psychiatric unit is where we're paying for it. Some of our work with BIS and EOC is really trying to cover that gap. And, for example, an outpatient detox would be able to help with the homeless shelter, for example, to bridge that gap. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call on Michael Axelrod to come tell you about Project Amend. The funding is specific for drug court and Proposition 36 clients. So it is a limited sample, if you will. They have to come through that. That's the criminal justice system. So they do have to be referred into those programs, and then they're assessed. And once they're assessed to need detoxification, then they'll be seen by Katie at our site, and we will offer daily detoxification support groups as well.
Hello. Oh, okay. We're good. I'm sorry. And then also, what kind of capacity do you have with that? I mean, if you all of a sudden, have this windfall of people, are you able to handle them within that program?
In the pilot program, yes. At this point, we're not anticipating, because it is a limited, it's a contained sample size. It's not open in that way. So yes, we'll be able to handle that for the 6 months. The downside will be at the end of 6 months, the program will go away at that point. Okay, Michael?
Hello, my name is Michael Axelrod, and I work for Project Amend Inc. Here in San Luis Obispo. And it's an honor to be able to address the commission. And first, on a personal note, I'm only up here today in the California Central Coast through the efforts of Ms. Warren. And it's just, I am so pleased to be able to stand here like this and address you and the rest of the commission. And I was brought up here just about 2 years ago this month to help finalize licensing requirements for the California Department of Alcohol and Drug Programs, so Project Amend could make the transition from sober living to residential detox and treatment. And the big stumbling block at the time was we needed a fire marshal's clearance. As a sober living, we're under certain regulations and guidelines, and then when you bump it up to detox and residential treatment, there's a whole higher level of regulations. And part of those regulations required a fire sprinkler system and alarm system at the cost of $20,000. And so I thought I was going to come up here and look like a hero and address the county and the city, and people would just be falling all over themselves to give us the funding. And that wasn't quite the case. And I made some sort of emotional pitch to the mayor and the city council and got the attention of Biz Steinberg and some of her colleagues over at EOC, and then they started advocating for us, and we were given $20,000 of community development grant block funds to complete our project, which was good at the time, and it also, because of some of the protocol involved in getting the funds and dispersing the funds, a lot of time was added to this. So right now where we're at is our fire sprinkler system is up. The excavation that needs to be done has been done from the city water supply to get it to our fire sprinkler system. And we're just waiting to get the permits to do the alarm system, which is maybe a couple weeks or a week and a half away. And at that point, we'll get the fire marshal's clearance. I then will package up the license, which has been ready for close to 2 years, and send it off to the state. And then the review process for the state, is anywhere up to 120 days. I hear because they are aware of the situation in this county, we might be able to expedite that, and I hope to be able to do that. We're going to be a 90-day residential treatment facility in three phases. The first phase will include detox for those that need it, medically supervised social model detox. And we won't really be open to just people who want to detox for 5 days, week and a half or so, and then leave our facility all clean, you know, detox-wise. Ideally, we believe that people have the best chance of establishing and maintaining ongoing sobriety if they do a 30, 60, 90-day program and then transition into sober living. So we will provide the detox for people to make a 30-day commitment to our program, and then hopefully they will stay, complete the 90-day program, and then they will transition into one of our sober livings or one of the area sober livings. And we're only able to provide detox through the efforts of Dr. Dan Gordon, who has made a commitment to us to be our medical director. He is a psychiatrist in the area with a strong background experience in substance abuse. And we're only where we are right now through the efforts of people like Jack Witter, who's the president of our board of directors, who's been working a lot longer and a lot harder than I have. I just got to come up towards the tail end kind of gravy train on the hard work of everybody else. So is there anything? We hope to make it affordable. We hope to make it ridiculously affordable to the people here in this county who need our facilities. Right now, the city, for reasons known only to them, have decided to limit us to 8 beds. So 4 of those will be designated for detox. We'll have 8 beds total at this time. We have the physical capacity and the staffing capabilities to handle 16 beds with maybe 6 for detox, and we hope to be able to get through some of the roadblocks that the city has put on us and expand to that, thus making it way more affordable than we'll be able to do at the, you know, initially. So is there anything I haven't said or any questions?
I have a question, Michael. Are you also tied to Prop 36 as well?
Well, currently we have a Proposition 36 contract with County Drug and Alcohol Services, but so we just house the people that go to their facility for Prop 36. When we are open, we will do our own in-house residential treatment, you know, group psychotherapy, individual one-on-one educations, that sort of thing. So we really wouldn't be involved with Prop 36. At that time.
And I understand this is just for the gentlemen, right?
Exactly. Adult males, 18 and over. Thank you.
Okay, so you have a couple of medical people here if you have specific questions about detoxification, certainly. And thank you so much for having us here. And again, the report and the current status memo is on our website. And periodically, I will post updates as we continue in this process.
I'm most familiar with the COPE program that's sponsored by Cottage in Santa Barbara. I know that that's been one that a lot of the psychiatrists in San Luis have sent patients to. Mm-hmm. Are the types of treatments that we're looking at for the county base, are they similar to the COPE program? I know that they've had a great success rate, and I was just wondering if, you know, I don't think we're reinventing the wheel by any means. But.
No, we're not reinventing the wheel, so my initial answer would be yes, although they also have access to a hospital-based facility, and so if they need it, the folks would go in there for, you know, the more advanced medical detox should they need it, and then come out. So they do have that.
My question again has to do with unmet need. Is it being tracked? If so, how and where does that information go?
Okay. A couple things. One, and again, very limited sample size. We are tracking what's happening currently because we have a walk-in clinic and folks do come in or they call and so forth. We do have a contract with Recovery Good Samaritan in Santa Maria, which is where we take clients and transport them and pay for them in Santa Maria. That's, again, specific for Prop 36 and drug court. But we are tracking some of that. We also have a an acuity scale where we assess each client that comes into our facilities as needing level 1, 2, or 3, level 3 being the residential or the detox pieces, and so we have some data about that. It's hovering right now about 10%. Again, you saw that it's only 2% in the service population, but the folks that are coming into our place, it's hovering around 10%.
I do have kind of a medically based question, actually two of them. One, with the social model program, what does happen? I know it's medically supervised, but during medical emergencies, how is that handled? And then also, is there any type of triage, you know, for the people that are coming in that this person's too high risk to go into that setting and needs to go into a hospital setting?
Okay. I don't know if our medical people want to come up, but we've had initial,
Hi, Dan Gordon, and I will be the medical director at Project Amend. Great questions. Each case will be reviewed by Michael Axelrod and myself. Any prospective entrant to the combined detoxification and treatment experience. If someone is with complex medical illnesses and might be just too precarious, especially in the first 3 days of detox, they would be referred to their private physician, to the emergency room if necessary, or whatever facility could help a person. There is 24-hour monitoring and supervision of all the people who will be in our social model detox beds. I would be available on an on-call basis. We hope to develop some relationships with primary care physicians in the community. And that's always a risk you take in doing social detox. But we will have personnel to discuss these cases as they sometimes become more complex than we had anticipated.
We have had initial discussions with community health centers. They've also been a very good collaborator currently in talking about the medical home, as you heard Biz talk about. Where would they go? Where would their home medical home be as well? So they're very willing to collaborate with us and work with us.
Can I just add one more thing? We at Project Amend are primarily, our mission is to help the impoverished and people coming out of prison and institutions, but we also will help the middle class, too, for any people who want to take care of our services. Thanks.
Yes. I have a question. Last week, I found a report on four promising programs that had been started throughout the country, and it turned out that one of those was in Santa Barbara, and it had to do with Cottage Hospital hiring a person to an addiction specialist for the emergency rooms, and then that person would work with the clients that came in who had drug and alcohol problems and possibly with their families and helping them locate resources. And part of the offshoot was from that was also that they helped find more resources in the community because there weren't enough to refer to. Is this something that our physicians have been aware of or that you think we might be able to do here in our county through our hospitals?
You know, I think many physicians in this county have shied away from becoming involved in a system like that or a triage program like that because there was fear that there weren't resources right here in county to send people to once they were identified as needing this service. I think once we have these programs in place, maybe a program like the one you referred to is possible.
Another recent development, really just as of this week, drug and alcohol services now located at the health campus, which of course also has the psychiatric health facility at it. And one of the things that we're going to be able to do is now send our staff down to the PUF unit and make an assessment for drug and alcohol problems, make a discharge plan and a referral plan before they even leave that psychiatric hospital. Previously, the client would be discharged to mental health and then to drug and alcohol. Now we're hoping for some efficiencies and some connection, human connection, the staff person to the person at the facility. So I think as we move down this path, it will become more common practice.
Star, I have a couple questions. One of them, when you talked about the physicians that are beginning to treat for opiates, is there a list out there? Or are they with 211, or how do we find them?
Well, we're just now developing a list. The physicians have to be trained and certified in Suboxone, and there are about four or five physicians now we could put together the list. There's not a set list at this point, but we really just are coming on with this as a community.
Okay. And my other question, I may have missed this, but is there any detox on site at the jail? And how are the clients handled out there?
Well, there is medical staff through the public health agency out at the jail. They do have alcohol, opiate, protocols that they follow out there. That's really about all that I know, but they cover it through the public health staff that are out at the jail.
So when you talk about Prop 36 and drug court clients, it's after they've been in jail and they're on an outpatient and enrolled in the program?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Usually Proposition 36 clients do not stay long in jail.
We've heard about the men's beds. Are there any women's beds? Are they in the near future?
Well, again, we need to locate the funding. One of the thoughts was that the facility that Carol was talking about could be converted for the women's facility, since the four men's beds will be here. The four women's beds could be here as well in San Luis. The Good Samaritan facility up in North County and Mr. Lujan's facility are all co-ed. So depending on the funding, yes, that could be converted. It will be a need. Right now it's about 60-40. Some of the research, 60% of our clients are men, 40% are women, so we will need it shortly.
Mm-hmm. I just had one question about the social model. What are the qualifications of the personnel who are there with the people for 24 hours?
Well, at this point, all staff in licensed facilities have to be certified as an alcohol and drug counselor. That is a state certification that they have to complete education and internship hours and so forth. And then they would be trained additionally upon that detoxification signs and symptoms, emergency response, how to take to the emergency room, that kind of thing. They should also be certified in CPR. And so right now we have a certification process for counselors. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
On the agenda, it shows that Commissioner Warren, you were going to say something more. So thank you very much. Dr. Graber, I presume Commissioner Warren is part of the overall program, so I'll thank you all when it's done.
I'm Susan Warren, and I'm with the Community Recovery Centers. I serve on the board of the Cambria Connection, and I'm the director over at North County Connection in Atascadero. And I wanted to speak a little bit to the community-based resources that are out there, because we're very different from what we've been hearing about tonight with detox and treatment. And I wanted to mention also we have Carolyn London here with us too, that's Lifestyles in Paso Robles, which is also another community-based resource recovery center. The difference for us is that the services that we all provide are free, anonymous, and confidential. And people can then access that without the fear of the stigma and the shame that goes along with it, losing their children, losing their jobs. It gives them that opportunity to research out and find out what they need. We've been doing this for 20 years now, and that's why you've heard from me in the past, because our frustration has been that when people would call us, most of the time it's family members wanting to know what to do with them because they don't want them anymore. And they get real frustrated. And our frustration was is that we didn't have any resources. It's been very difficult in this county, as maybe many of you know, that we didn't have a lot of residential treatment. We didn't have detox. We just have not had the services to refer people to. And, you know, 12-step programs that are out there as peer support programs can pick up and be there on that day-to-day basis. But some people need a lot more. They're going to need detox or they're going to need residential. And that's not something that, we can provide. We can provide the ongoing support for everyone. We also work with the community to try to help educate, and that's part of what we've done over the years is to come here and advocate, and I really appreciate from all of you the support and the help that we've gotten and the respect of bringing this issue to the forefront. And I know in the beginning we kind of thought, oh, is this really a health issue? Well, you're not the only ones that have thought that. You know, that's a huge issue in the country. You know, it's so common that in this country, people think that, you know, this is a moral issue, this is a behavioral issue. And we're only beginning now to accept that, we've known for many years that it is a disease, it is treatable, and people do recover. And that's our passion, is to get the word out here, to let people know, you know, for Pete's sakes, come for help. You know, don't string it along for years till your organs are failing, till your marriages have failed and your children are running away. You know, we don't have to go that far. We can go out and seek help and find the resources that will help us become productive members of the community again. So with that, I mean, I had things prepared, but I think we've heard so much tonight already about treatment. Just to let you know, the difference with us and what we have available is we're there 7 days a week. Our services are free, anonymous, confidential. You don't even have to give us. We like to have your first name, but we never have anybody's last name. We don't keep any files. We're just there to say, you know, we're here to help you. We want to listen to you and find out what you need and get you pointed in the right direction so you and your family can get healthy again. And I guess in closing, the key to all this is the education and understanding that we are not bad people that need to get good. We're sick people that need to get well. And I think we're beginning to see that. There's a huge national movement going on right now, which is you've got everything from celebrity rehab to the other programs that are on TV in looking at rehabs and what people go through. And I think it's doing a lot for the communities in education, because I'm getting a lot of comments from people. Like, wow, I never knew that it was that difficult. And the other piece I think that our celebrities are helping us understand is that this very few people ever just get clean and sober and stay that way for the rest of their life. This is a disease that relapses. And it can relapse whether you've got 6 months or 14 days or you have 21 years. It doesn't make any difference. Life happens, and we have divorces, we have deaths. There's all kinds of things that happen. You lose jobs. Whatever it is, it can set somebody off. A lot of people have surgeries, even though they've got years in recovery. And when they have to get put on the pain medications, then a lot of times people will relapse then. So it's a real difficult process, and it's a lifelong process, not unlike diabetes. You know, we can be in abstinence, and it's just something that we do get well, but it takes a lot of support, and a lot of support from our peers, from services that we need to provide out there, whether it's residential treatment or sober living or detox, and also just from our community. You know, yes, we can do bad things while we're under the influence, but if we're not under the influence in the first place, we won't be doing those things. So it'll save our county and our communities a lot of money and heartache and frustration and lighten the load at the jail. Thank you.
Well, Susan, I think the community owes you a debt of gratitude for 10 years at North County Connection, so thank you.
Okay. Are there any members of the public that would like to come forward and say something or make a comment or ask a question? Okay. I think we have to... I thought there was one more person there. Yes. Okay. Please come forward, Maria Fabula from Nonprofit Support Center.
I'd just like to say I did ask Maria to come because she's just been so important in our ability to provide the services we do and become stronger as a nonprofit. And they're just doing some marvelous things here in our county that will help all the smaller nonprofits be able to really strengthen what we do. Thank you.
Thank you, and good evening. My name is Maria Fabula, and I am here representing the Nonprofit Support Center. We are a nonprofit, too, an organization that provides leadership, consulting, advocacy, and resources for nonprofit organizations in both Santa Barbara County and in San Luis Obispo County. We, like you, envision a sector of vital, dynamic nonprofit organizations that enrich the life of our communities. Originally started with a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, the Nonprofit Support Center has provided programs and services for the past 13 years, and since 2004, we have provided services here in San Luis Obispo County. Our resources and services focus on four core areas for nonprofit organizations: fund development, board effectiveness, management and planning, and leadership. All of these, we believe, will bring all organizations to better mission success. We believe that nonprofit organizations that practice these best practices will achieve mission success quickly. In 2007, the Nonprofit Support Center provided program services to more than 2,500 individuals in both counties, and in San Luis Obispo alone, we provided services to over 700 individuals. These individuals included board members, staff members, and volunteers of nonprofit organizations of all sizes. On April 1st of this year, we are very excited to be opening our San Luis Obispo Resource Center. This resource center will be dedicated to everything nonprofit, including access to a database of over 90,000 grant makers, access to over 250 books and publications about nonprofit management, and access to affordable trainings to help nonprofits do their good work better. Many of the organizations that you heard about today and that you hear about regularly are nonprofits in our community that need our resources. We feel that nonprofit organizations that practice best practices, collaborate more, are able to leverage their dollars more, and are able to reduce the duplication of services. I would encourage you to visit our new site. It will be at the KCBX Public Radio offices in San Luis Obispo, or to visit us online at www.nscsb.org. And I look forward to serving our nonprofits. And if I can answer any questions, I would be happy to. Thank you for having me tonight. Any questions
from commissioners?
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming and being here.
Thank you.
I'd just like to put in one plug that they just started working and gotten a grant with Cal Poly to offer some volunteer management training. And we're also looking for a training for fund development for board members and looking for those 55 and over that would love to learn how to be good board members.
Thank you, Susan.
Yes.
Thank you all very much. And I really do want to applaud Commissioner Warren. Those of us who've been on the commission for a while remember that she was here constantly as an advocate for detox. This program has been just really great. Thank you very much. We really appreciate the work that you've put into it and the work that everybody that presented has put into their presentation. So thank you all again. It's a very important subject, and we will visit it again, I'm sure, in the near future. All right, then we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the healthcare access program update by our advocate, Mary Cota, and also a report on medically fragile homeless. And I believe Jody Smith is here also.
Good evening. I left give you commissioners a report of the last 6 months of the first year, which is the 2007-2008 year. And I was looking over the data and realizing that it's pretty similar to the first year that I started. This is the second year in this program that I'm the coordinator for EOC Healthcare Access Program. I'm the patient advocate for community health centers, and I'm the access advocate for county medical program, and I'm a support person for St. Cal, which will be managing the Medi-Cal and a couple other programs here in our county. But I was looking at the data and seeing that, again, we can easily see that the population that's falling through the cracks is that population of age 22 to 64. That's very challenging for them to find a medical home. And we're realizing that it is going to take all of us working together, integrating all these nonprofits. Like Maria mentioned, I came from Santa Barbara County, and that's something that, I think is going to be a wonderful thing that's going to happen here in our county, because we have over like 600 nonprofits in our county, and I think we have exceptional services, and I think we have exceptional people here in our county and exceptional leadership. And I'm happy to be a process of that and be here in this county serving. I'm not sure if anybody has any questions in regards to my job, my position, and what I've been doing out in the community. I cover the whole county. I'm the only one in my program. And out of my program, I do education and outreach, which that's been ongoing and will, you know, continue to be ongoing. Direct referrals, advocacy. Advocacy could be anybody, any age. It could be a child with needing anesthesia, needing funding for anesthesia. It could be a senior citizen needing wheelchair. I mean, I don't even know what I haven't covered. Everything from cake, you know, where do I get the wedding cake to detox. So thank you so much, too, for detox, because I don't know what I would do without those programs. And I don't know what I would have done in the last 2 years if it hadn't been for the Santa Barbara Health Regional Authority. This is their provider list, and it's a blessing to our county that they're going to be here managing Medi-Cal, because I've sent so many residents from our county to providers there. And so, you know, that's going to be a big plus, especially with specialists here in our county, that we've lost so many doctors before I came into this program. So I don't know what else to say except communication is certainly improving, and I think collaborations are certainly improving, and I really enjoy us working together, so thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And every month it's interesting to read your report, and I'm not exactly sure how you manage to do all of what you do. And I particularly found the mid-year report of interest and your suggestions. And if I'd just like to point out that Mary's worked, I think, very hard to come up with good suggestions and things that we need to continue to think about as a health commission. And so I'm just going to read a couple of these. Development of a countywide long-term aftercare clinical case management system for needy and chronic users. What a good idea. Development of a chronic disease clinic management program that would make it easy, just to paraphrase, to track people and monitor them after they're out of the loop, maybe. Improve collaborations and communications, which you just said you think are improving, which is wonderful. Creating and maintaining a working staff directory. That sounds like, is that kind of what you're, that you have from the...
I tell you, yeah. I call them Bibles. I, you know, if it wasn't for George Dodge up there in North County, he expanded this to Paso now. And, you know, since I started this program, I always provided one. I'm regionalized. I come from a county where we always say North County, South County, Mid County. So I'm doing the same thing here in this county. It's just kind of bringing it in. Mid-County, San Luis Obispo, North County is San Margarita and above, and includes Shandon, you know, and all those other little cities, Creston and San Miguel, and then Coastal, and then, of course, South County, you know, the five cities and Nipomo and so on. So
sounds like a really
regionalize.
Good, sounds like a really good student intern project. Who knows? Anyway, some thoughts.
Well, we're working on it, and I think Jody's going to help me add to this, because we got so much exciting news to share about the medically fragile homeless and how that is coming along, and also the collaboration there is incredible. We got like over 35 providers. So,
okay. Well, thank you very much, Mary.
Anybody have any questions in regards to this job? Because I have other jobs.
I'm with Chair Enns about your ability to do so much, you know, and you've become more relaxed in the last year too in doing it.
Thank
so
you.
You wear it well. Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioners. It's been such a pleasure for me this evening to be surrounded by so many of our collaborative partners and to hear their exciting and innovative new programs, the pilot project with drug and alcohol services, the soon-to-be licensed facility with Project Amends is just so exciting. You know, we may not be a county with a lot of money, but we certainly are a county with amazing, dedicated human beings that go out of their way to make sure that we don't overlook the unmet needs. Every day I talk to my partners, and they're constantly finding, like Mary was saying, one more unmet need, and we work together in a collaborative to address those needs. What's very exciting for our county this year is we are working on the 10-year plan to end homelessness. This is a plan that's driven by HUD out of Washington, D.C., and we have a consultant firm. It's a legal firm. Their name is Homebase, and they'll be working with the partners to put together this exciting program. We all know that we're not going to wipe out homelessness, but we're sure going to do our darndest to address the issues. What I wanted to let you know is one of my wonderful partners, Carol Hatley, is here tonight, and the Housing Authority, they've not only given a project for drug and alcohol services, they've also put up some project units to address the needs of the medically fragile. We have three rooms, they're small studios, and we'll be able to take people from the hospital and temporarily house them in a very safe, easy to access location. And it's wonderful. We have so many elderly folks with serious, serious conditions who are homeless. They need the bed rest. We have young people that have had some unfortunate accidents or illnesses, and they will need this time for respite and recovery. What this will do is save dollars, countless dollars, for our hospitals. With the new laws that are being passed, the medically fragile cannot be just discharged from the hospital without a place to go. And our community will be providing a safe place for folks to recover. We're also working with a 10-year plan. We have a committee that's prevention and discharge, which is part of the 10-year plan. And our group that works on the medically fragile will be inputting on the 10-year plan our proposals to provide respite and recovery to our clients. So we're getting there. We don't have a lot of money for our program at the moment, and we do rely on Transitional Food and Shelter, and they're out of Paso Robles, very small nonprofit, and the generosity of the homeless commission that I have through the shelter. We're looking to come up with some single beds. We need three of them right now. We need two small, the itty-bitty student size refrigerators. We need some small microwaves, some very small tables and chairs. so we can furnish these three units. So we're doing this on a shoestring, but I know that with everyone pulling together, we'll be able to get all of the needed items for these rooms. So I want to thank you all tonight. It was a pleasure to listen to my partners, and I think you've got a real glimpse into real comprehensive health services that we're all able to provide. Thank you. Did you have a question?
Well, actually, FYI, Cal Poly is trading out all of the little refrigerators in the dorm rooms. And I think they're all on the loading dock by the services department, and they're either giving them away or charging like $10, and they're brand new.
We'll have to zip over there tomorrow and pick them up. Okay. Thank you.
If I may add something, please, in regards to that, the Homeless Services Committee Council, the four subgroups is going to be the leadership group, the planning committee group, and the prevention discharge planning group, and then the supportive services committee group. So I wanted to come back up and say this because it shows how all of us working together is what, is making all these different programs happen and work efficiently and effectively, and sharing these dollars, and how important it is that we're all a spoke on that wheel. So I wanted to bring that back up because here we have four hospitals, we have prison, we have this, and just tying it in all together. And that it's going to include our wineries. We have a lot of wineries. We have prime real estate here. And just a very beautiful, well-knit community. I think we're just the prime real estate of this whole state. So I want to thank you each, too, for what you do, too. So.
Are there any members of the public that would like to comment on this subject? Okay. Thank you again very much for being here, Mary and Jody. Let you go. We really appreciate the work you do, and we appreciate that you take your time to be here in the evening to tell us about it. Okay, moving on to the Health Agency Director's Report. As everybody knows, Dr. Thomas has moved on to greener pastures. I hope he thinks they're greener pastures. And so we're very pleased to have Mr. Hamm here to give the monthly report.
Thank you. Good evening. Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director. I think Greg is feeling this week that they're greener pastures. He has mentioned to Gene that he's not missing the budget development process that we're wrapping up this week. I'll talk about that just a little bit, but today's Monday. Tomorrow's Board of Supervisors consent calendar, we do have a contract with Dr. Thomas as a backup health officer, so we're not going to let him go just quite yet. So, a couple weeks ago, we contracted with Craig McMillan. Dr. McMillan is retiring right now from Lake County. He's actually overlapping a little bit these last couple weeks, but he's going to be joining us on a more regular basis here and will be the interim county health officer between now and whenever we're able to find a permanent replacement for Dr. Thomas. So we're very lucky to have him. He's very experienced, worked in Mendocino for quite a few years as their health officer, and then took a short 4 or 5 year stint to engage in clinical practice, and then decided he wanted to go back to being a health officer in Lake County, and he did that for, I think, 4 or 5 years, and so we were lucky to find him. He's one of those individuals looking forward to possibly retiring here if he can find a place that he can afford. So while he's working for us, he's studying the real estate market. The health care reform bill that had been essentially sponsored by Assembly Speaker Nunez and it was very, very strongly supported by the governor, failed to make it out of the Senate Health Committee. I don't know if it was last week or the week before, but it's essentially dead. And there had been a tremendous amount of energy invested in Sacramento in evaluating that piece of legislation. And I think there are a lot of folks in the state legislature who thought that it was close, it was a strong effort. And I think there are a lot of folks who are very disappointed that it failed. In terms of my peers and county administrators around California, I think the majority of them were actually pleased that it did not pass. It was a proposal that was pretty complicated and fraught with some problems as far as counties were concerned in terms of the cost. I think a lot of press coverage on the fact that it was a bill that they expected to cost, coincidentally, about $14 billion to implement, which is right about what the state is looking at in terms of a budget deficit for 08-09. So it certainly didn't help that proposal that it came about right now at a point in time where California is facing a very significant financial gap in its budget for next year. And before I talk a little bit about our gap in our budget, SenCal Health, as Mary mentioned, has actually come about. They're going to go live on March 1st. So between now and your next board meeting, Medi-Cal beneficiaries will switch over from the fee-for-service system that's existed in this county for decades and will become part of the Medi-Cal Managed Care program that SenCal Health is administering for Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties combined. It will provide a medical home. I think there's a lot of good, very good things that it's going to do. And I consider myself fortunate to be one of the five appointees by this Board of Supervisors to the new SenCal Health Board of Directors, along with Supervisor Asajian, Dr. Bravo, Alan Iftinick, and Robert, of a Medicare beneficiary, who is the fifth representative. I've only met him, and I really am sorry that I can't remember his last name. But anyway, he's a volunteer. He's a HICAP counselor, and I think is going to be a very good member of the board and represent the interests of beneficiaries very, very competently on the SenCal board. They meet every other month. Most of their meetings are going to be in Santa Maria because it's sort of halfway. They are going to have a meeting in San Luis Obispo on March 19th. I think they meet the third Wednesday, the evening of the third Wednesday of every month. So the next meeting is going to be in San Luis Obispo, and those meetings are open to the public. Last thing I wanted to touch on briefly is the county departments are submitting their budget, their status quo, so-called budgets, to the CAO's County Administrative Office this Friday. The Board of Supervisors held a special meeting on a Tuesday that they would have ordinarily been dark following Martin Luther King holiday on January, whatever that was, the 22nd. They are going to be holding another special meeting on February 19th, which is the Tuesday following the Monday holiday. And at that meeting, they're going to continue their discussion, and they're going to hear from the county administrator about the county's current financial situation. County administrator has forecast about a $20 million gap between the amount of funds that it would take for us to sustain the current level of effort that we're investing in all the programs countywide, and the means of financing that will be available to support that. So it's going to be a very, very difficult next several months for county department managers, and then ultimately in June for the Board of Supervisors as they try and figure out how to balance the budget while minimizing the impacts that reduced levels of funding are going to have on the various programs that the county provides. If the $20 million number that's being projected ends up being close to that, the health agencies' programs combined are probably going to be $3.5 to $4 million of that. I have briefed the commission previously on the obligation that the Board of Supervisors has directed all department heads to come up with both the status quo budget and a list of things that the board, if they had to, would implement to reduce the requirements for general fund financing for county programs down to the level of our level of general fund support in the current fiscal year. And as I indicated, for the health agency, that's likely to be something around $4 million. We're working on that list of what we're calling reverse budget augmentation requests. We probably will have another week or so after this week to finish them up. We'll be submitting them to the CAO's office. We're working very closely with all of our employees on to make sure that we have their input on what those things would be. The list will become public, and that will begin a period of hopefully extensive analysis, and the Health Commission will have a copy. Be happy to obtain whatever input you'd like to provide. In terms of the relative order of the items, as I've indicated before to you. It's very, very challenging process for folks who have a passion for a particular group of services that the county provides. It's pretty easy for folks to look at a list of service level reductions and find fault with all of them and to essentially say, well, whatever the board does, they shouldn't do any of these things. And that will be the challenge for the Board of Supervisors. They're not going to be able to balance the budget without making service level reductions somewhere. And yet nobody will like any of the ideas for what's going to be required. So I just wanted to touch on that because by the time you meet again, a lot of that information will have become public and will be the subject of public scrutiny, editorial opinions in the Tribune, letters to the editor. There has already been some anxiety about one of the things that we've indicated preliminarily is on the list, which is a consolidation of the two North County mental health outpatient clinics into a single clinic, which would essentially mean that we'd either be in Paso Robles or Atascadero rather than having two clinics in the North County. We have one clinic in the South County. We have one in SLO. That doesn't save very much money, but it's just an example of one of the kinds of things that people are going to see on the list. And because the list has been out there, folks have already started showing up at board meetings on Tuesday mornings to talk during public comment about how that's not a good idea. So there's going to be a lot more of that kind of public input about those things as over the next several months. So those were all the things I wanted to touch on. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
I guess I have a list of them. So that the public and myself get the timelines clear, you're meeting with the board on February 19th to talk about your short list. Has your list changed since we got it?
No, we're not going to be talking on the 19th about the list. I think the 19th is a continuation of, as I understand it, it's a continuation of the dialogue that the board engaged with staff and with the public on that January 22nd, which was essentially a status report on the big picture financial forecast. And there was a special presentation made by the sheriff, DA, and chief probation officer about their perception of the growing gang problem in the county and what they thought was how the county should react to that. The board created a small subcommittee with a couple board members, and they're going to be back on February 19th with more information about that. And because all of the departments are submitting their status quo budgets by this Friday, the CAO's office will be able to put all that information together and come back on as early as February 19th with something that's a little bit more firm than the forecast that they've been talking about for the last several months. So they will at least have the benefit of all of the work that all of the financial managers and the program managers and all the operating departments have been investing over the past month, putting our budgets together. So they'll put all that into their big spreadsheet, and they'll turn the crank, and they'll be able to advise the board on what they think the gap is.
Okay. I guess what I'm getting at, Jeff, is that will this commission have a chance to weigh in at the board before the final decisions are made?
At a minimum, the commission's recommendations or your testimony as a group or individually will be welcome at the Board of Supervisors hearings. One of the things, and as I understand the process, it's been pretty much this way for years. I think this year there's going to be a little bit more interest in some of the detailed proposals that department heads are being, I don't even want to call it a proposal. Some of the things we're obligated to do to give the board the information that they're going to need to use to balance the budget. But we submit our budget requests early, February 8th. We'll be submitting our list of things and our characterization of the implications of those changes to the board, to the CAO's office shortly thereafter. We'll make it available to the public. The CAO has until about the early May to put together a balanced budget. This county administrator has an obligation to recommend to the board a balanced budget. What he chooses to include and what he chooses not to include in terms of service level reductions won't really be known until the proposed budget is published and is made available to the public. And certainly from that point on, public debate and input will be solicited and will be welcomed by the Board of Supervisors. As an advisory body, you're free to engage in whatever process you know, the monthly meetings that you hold, you're free to engage in whatever process you'd like to engage in. We'll give you the information as soon as it's available. I'd suggest that you might want to set some time, at least a little bit of time, on each month's agenda for input about the budget as it evolves. Certainly, if you're going to take up a discussion next month about Dr. Thomas's wish list, from my perspective, it wouldn't really make much sense to take up a discussion about that outside of the context of our 08-09 budget.
I guess I have a couple concerns, having studied the list quite a bit and seeing that, you know, the Health Commission functions as a safety net almost. In listening to what happens out in the community, the reporting that we get from CHC and the Ombudsman program, and that I guess our fate should be no different than other agencies concerned with safety, you know, because that's what we do, is we listen to what's happening in the community and make recommendations forthcoming. So I guess I want to make sure that you're viewing our role in this and the public health agency's role as that of any other county agency that has to do with safety, because, I mean, people are medically fragile, as we've heard. People need help. People have, you know, addictions that we don't want to lose sight of those in the larger budget discussions. I mean, it's like water testing. You want to knock that in half, you know, but yet we have major spills from
the family. Actually, I don't want to knock that in half.
Well, I know you don't, but you have to do something.
Well, I don't have to do anything other than identify information that will allow the decision makers to make the informed decision. And what I do not have the opportunity or the luxury of doing is submitting a status quo budget, if, in fact, it does require an increase in general fund support of $4 million, and then just telling them that if they can't sustain that level of funding to the health agency, they should just do whatever they want. I have an obligation to give them information about the implications of the decisions that they might make.
But do you also have an obligation to give them recommendations? Say, like, the spill at CMC is going to garnish some fines from them for what they did for the pollution. So now why shouldn't you be at that table saying, well, you know, part of this mitigation should supplement our water testing program? It would be an appropriate connection. But, you know, I don't know how creative you want to be on those, and if you want public.
Yeah, and I'll admit to some ignorance on that specific point. A fine that is levied by a polluter, off the top of my head, I don't know where that money goes or what kind of flexibility exists around its use. But I certainly would like to be at the table if there is any opportunity to increase the revenues that flow to the health agency to minimize the service level reductions that might need to be made. One of the things that we've done and are continuing to attempt to do is make sure that we leave no stone unturned in terms of money that we could use to supplement our programs as the level of general fund support is increasingly threatened. We're trying to make sure that we're operating as efficiently as we can. The Board of Supervisors expects all those things from us, all of the county departments. They certainly expect them from me as the health agency director. And we want to make sure we're doing all those things. But we still have a $4 million gap to bridge. And I hope the board takes all of the reductions out of the sheriff's office and the road fund and the DA's office and every place except for the health agency.
Well, you know, I guess for me it's all connected. You know, the health of the people. And I'll use the CMC spill as a prime example. You've got a bunch of partially treated sewage that's full of Hep C, endocrine disruptors, any type of medications that those folks are taking, whether they're neuro center type of drugs, that have now spilled out into the bay, the estuary, and the ocean. You know, so for me, I would be wanting to expand the type of testing we're doing, but, you know, I'm at this point probably not going to be asking you to do that. But, you know, it's just those types of connections that happen over here, but they impact a larger population. Same with the mentally ill, you know. If you disrupt some of those programs and some of those people go off their meds, then we're back into a vicious cycle. So I guess I would like us to approach the board with that type of a holistic vision of where we fit in, you know, and your programs fit in the larger community. Because, you know, gang task force, you look at some of what the endocrine disruptors do, and they make people crazy, you know?
Yeah, some of the folks on the mental health board and the drug and alcohol advisory board were present on January 22nd and shared their observations about the relative value of the services that we provide with the board. Certainly, you're all welcome to do that. And ultimately, once we have a list of programs that everybody can object to the reductions that are on the list, that would give you some very, very specific things to focus on. Our obligation is to do the best job we can to forecast the consequences to the community of each of the things that will be on that list. You know, starting with, you know, a half of a public health department staff person who's doing a child car seat safety program. You know, we make 350 to 400 approved car seats available to, you know, needy families and low-income families in the community, and we do 6 classes a month to help people learn how to install those and to ensure that they're installed correctly. We offer classes to folks who the court refers, you know, because they've been cited for seatbelt violations, essentially not having the car seats installed. That's only a $30,000 program, but it has a great value to the community. And you start to imagine the consequences of us not doing it anymore, and you can have a pretty good little story to tell there. And we'll make sure that the story is told. And that's all I can do. That's all we can do is make sure that the board understands that these things are going to have consequences if they're decisions that they're forced to make.
So getting back to the schedule that you were talking about, it is your job to give the board, or are we talking about the CAO, the information as regards the consequences of making cuts? Because it sounds like...
It's both.
It sounds like the CAO is going to take all this information and then go into his office and decide how to rearrange the numbers, or am I incorrect?
Well, I do think he works at the will and pleasure of the board, and he has an obligation to recommend to them a balanced budget. I don't think he's just going to take what we all give him and go in his office and rearrange the numbers. He has to be held accountable by the board for the proposed budget.
I understand that, but it would be his perception of what would be the best for the county overall based on the information that he's received from the staff. Is that correct?
I think yes, although when I said both, I know that the white paper that we'll write, that we're in the process of writing for each one of the things on the list, is going to go also directly to each member of the Board of Supervisors for their edification and ultimately for their consideration.
So
they'll have all that information at their disposal.
So in terms of advocacy, at what point would it be expedient for the Health Commission to weigh in?
Well, I wouldn't want to suggest that you delay weighing in, but I have suggested to both the Mental Health Board and the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board, and I would suggest to you that the timing of weighing in, probably between when the proposed budget becomes a public document and we all have an opportunity to see what the CAO is recommending, between that point in time and when the board decides, is the primary time to affect public policy on these questions. To do so beforehand might be a little bit early for when you would want to expend your energy. You won't know what's being recommended yet.
So you're talking about May and June.
Yeah, and I don't know when the proposed budget will be published and when it will be. They take it to the Board of Supervisors and have the board adopt it as the proposed budget, and that's the sort of the public unveiling of the spending of the CAO's recommended spending plan. And I think it's early May. It leaves about a month for the document to be studied and subject to that kind of evaluation, and for people to develop their recommendations. The list is something that we've already distributed, a very preliminary version that we developed months ago. And in a couple weeks, the list that we'll be submitting to the CAO and to the board will be available. And we will certainly share it with you.
Commissioner Donnelly?
I could just make a suggestion. Maybe a good starting place for us is I think that we should be discussing that list among ourselves and maybe doing some, you know, looking at how we would prioritize it and how, what, you know, what our recommendations might be. And when it does come out, the official proposed budget, then we can look and see, you know, where we can help to educate the Board of Supervisors or what we want to advocate for at that time.
So do I understand that perhaps we would want to discuss this at our next meeting, which is March? So maybe for March and April, the subject would appear on the agenda and we could take parts of it. Then that sounds like a good idea.
I would do March, April, and May so that if there's any loose ends before it goes to the board that we're prepared and we have people ready to go.
Yeah, I'm thinking that maybe by our May meeting it might be out. And then we really would have something to talk about.
Yeah, if I understood your comments, if you're interested in helping with the development of the relative placement of these things on the list, that would be something that you'd want to engage in earlier rather than later. I have an obligation to deliver that list to them before your next meeting. So, but it's not too late for you to engage in your public, you know, discussion, ask questions, you know, hear from the public and make recommendations about the relative order of those things and any other recommendations that you might want to make to the board. Certainly, you have months to do that.
Okay, well, I think that we'll work on that between now and the next meeting as to what we're going to do. There appears to be someone from the public who would like to make a comment on this subject. Mr. Arnold?
Thank you, Chairman Enns. Jeff, I recognize you're in a very difficult spot. I just wonder, when you go down your proposed list of proposed cuts, if it's possible for you to say, as you mentioned on the seat belts, we'll save this much, but there's a potential cost, or, you know, in each category, how much are we being penny wise and pound foolish, I guess is what I'm getting at. Any kind of analysis that would give us what the losses are for that budget reduction.
As I mentioned, it will certainly be our goal to, as clearly as possible, articulate what we think the likely consequences of those service level reductions will be to the community.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I agree with that suggestion, and if it can be quantified, that's even better. I think in terms of the most immediate need, as I understand the meeting of the 19th, because three departments had the opportunity, in the three law enforcement related departments had the opportunity to present a sense of urgency about a problem that is just emerging in this county, and essentially we're trying to make the case for being held harmless from the cuts that other departments would be making. And because one of the directions the board may well be giving on February 19th is whether indeed these law enforcement departments will be held to a different standard based on public safety issues, which would mean deeper cuts by other departments, perhaps by all the other departments. Perhaps the very first advice, if you could go so far as to take it today and then start going through the list in detail and the other things that have been suggested, is if you were to inform the board that your suggestion is that the health department be defined in their minds. This is just words. This is just labeling, but I think it's critically important because it's also framing. That the health department be defined in their minds as a public safety department, and that it should be treated as other public safety departments are treated. Lives are saved by this department. Deaths are prevented. Quality of life is preserved by this department. And that's, it deserves the same respect as the departments that do it by suppressing crime. And so that's my immediate suggestion. Just one other comment on the list. One of the suggestions was to stop the videotaping and broadcasting of your meetings. And the education the community receives on health issues through being able to watch your meetings and be educated about the issues, if you tried to purchase that same education in terms of public service announcements, I think it would cost a lot more. So I hope you would also, as you go through the list, recognize that that one, as far as you're concerned, is a non-starter. And it's coming from me, a member of the public, not from you. This isn't about giving you the chance to grandstand. I don't care whose faces are up there any given month. It's about public education about issues the public needs to know about. And AGP Video performs a hugely valuable service by making that possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening, and I think you just reiterated the Commissioner Hetherington's point about us being a public safety agency, and certainly we wouldn't want to stop being televised. I thank you for your comments. I think that we all really agree that this is, hopefully, people are watching these meetings and are getting and are learning things. I'm amazed at the people who do watch it. Any other comments on the health agency director's report from commissioners? No. All right, then let's move on to the health commission updates. I think we can probably continue this meeting without a break unless I hear let's finish. Okay. all right, I'll go on with my report then. A couple of things. First of all, the Obesity Prevention Task Force had a joint meeting, collaborative meeting, with Heal Slow last month. It has been conceptually agreed to merge these things that we are we're both working on to avoid duplications of services, and there will be a coordinating committee meeting coming up later this month. First, each of the sort of sub-task force groups will be meeting prior to that, and I am on the community mobilization task force, so that meeting is next week. So further, information will come next month. And then the next thing that I wanted to talk about was, and then the other thing I did want to say about the task force, we are having a meeting tomorrow with Cal Poly's PR respective staff regarding our RFP for a social marketing campaign. So we're still pursuing the things that we were setting out to do. So it's going to be kind of exciting. And then I wanted to talk about the Tobacco Coalition. I did not go to the December meeting, but I have the minutes, and I just wanted to touch on a couple of highlights from that meeting. And one was that the coalition has sent out letters to our legislators, Blakesley and Maldonado, regarding money that they received from Big Tobacco in terms of contributions. And Sam Blakesley has donated that money back to local charities. And I thought that was very admirable. And I do not know, since this report, whether Mr. Maldonado has done the same. Also, the smoke-free outdoor areas in Morro Bay and Atascadero, there are youth groups that have been very active in promoting this. Morro Bay does have smoke-free beaches, but not parks. And these groups of young people are galvanized to get this going in both Atascadero and Morro Bay. Atascadero State Hospital, I think maybe we all remember hearing about that in October. They were to go smoke-free, but actually there was a loophole, and so they are not smoke-free at the current time. But it is part of Atascadero, and I believe their Atascadero is probably being lobbied to override by enacting some sort of legislation to actually make them come into conformance with that. The cessation programs for the tobacco coalition, there's two, one that deals directly with people who want to quit smoking, I guess I say ordinary people, and then there's the people who are about to have children or live with children, the inordinary people. Yeah, extraordinary people. And it's called Baby's First Breath, and it's funded by First Five. The six-month quit rates for these groups are for the pregnant women and new parents, and for the parents and other family members of children up to five are 31% and 42%, which is much higher than the general overall cessation rate of 29% for the ordinary smokers who want to quit. However, that is 29% of people that have attended have quit, so that's better than nothing. And I think we can still applaud the county in pushing forward with the tobacco agenda. Then you all received from me, I just forwarded on my email that I received from the Tobacco Coalition regarding a letter of support for tobacco retail licensing. And I don't know if you all had a chance to read the they're putting together a packet of materials for education and then are asking for people to write letters of support. Now, that can be individuals, but I thought it would be I thought we could discuss that briefly here to see if we would be interested also in writing a letter of support as the commission, that being important in terms of who we are. So I'd like to open that for a little bit of discussion. The other alternative is that we just move it to the agenda next month and have someone from tobacco control come in and talk to us about this program. So. Hello?
What's the timeline on the letter?
It is not a rush. We do not have to rush writing this letter, but I did want to get it on the agenda for tonight. I agendized it under my report just to either start us thinking about it or to go ahead and it seemed a little bit like a no-brainer to me. I mean, but perhaps we want to have further discussion and we can have Susan Hughes come and talk to us next month. Any comments on that?
I'm good with going with it tonight. That's something that I think we've been advocating for a long time.
Okay. Commissioner Donnelly?
Just for discussion purposes, I am very much in support of it. And the only thing, if we do write letters or whatever, we decide to do that, we also make sure that, because thinking financially about it, that the fees, the licensing fees, are high enough to support the actual enforcement of it, because I think that that's the key to success of programs like that.
Okay, so to paraphrase, that there be enough money in it to support it. That would be part of the letter. Okay. Does anyone else have any comments? Then I'd entertain a motion to have the commission write a letter in support of the tobacco retail licensing, stating specifically that the fees involved need to cover the costs of enforcement. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second? It's been moved and seconded to do what I just said. And is there any discussion of the motion? All right. Then we'll call for a vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Abstentions. The motion has passed unanimously, and I will write said letter. Thank you very much, and I'm sure the Tobacco Control Coalition will be very pleased as well. Now, one last thing, trying to get us out of here, but the Community Environmental Council of Santa Barbara forwarded to me a very interesting report that they had received from UCSB, some master's students who wrote a report on pharmaceuticals in wastewater streams, disposal practices, and policy options in Santa Barbara. Well, that seemed to be right up the alley that we've been following in terms of concerns about this. It's a quite lengthy and quite interesting report, and I thought I could part with it, actually. I could part with it and hand it over to either Commissioner Hetherington or Commissioner Garena, because basically what they are in the abstract, it says we recommend implementing a disposal program and so forth. And it found that Santa Barbara residents, I think this is astounding, were willing to pay $1.55 per prescription. But then, you know, everybody's wealthy in Santa Barbara, I guess, to support a pharmaceutical disposal program. That would generate a huge amount of money, and it's an excellent idea. And, of course, there would be a lot to discuss about that kind of approach. But
we won't fight over it.
All right. And then so I'm going to pass it over to you, and I think you'll find it very interesting. Thank you very much. And that ends my report for this month. And so let's start on my right with Commissioner. One other thing I did have to say was that I was fortunate enough to have the time to go to the North County Connection open house that they had for their 10-year celebration. And I found it very moving. Commissioner Warren talked for maybe an hour and a half about the program there, about the need for it, and then many of the board members and people who are involved with that facility spoke, and it was great, and I'm glad I was able to be there, and I thank you for your participation and for everybody who that board for North County Connection and the other programs. I'm sure there are others, but I hadn't had actual contact. So now my report is over. And Commissioner Donnelly, do you have a report?
Nothing to report.
Commissioner Warren?
Just a short report from the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board. And they're following a process that's been done at the Mental Health Board, where all the different board members are assigned a different program at Drug and Alcohol Services, and really speaking to the people that are putting on the program. And it's my understanding, I think they're going to be visiting some of the programs, but it gives them the opportunity to really have some in-depth understanding of what's going on with all the various, from adult treatment to their POGUE program for the pregnant and parenting moms, to Prop 36 and drug court. And it'll just give them a great opportunity to really have a good understanding of the department.
Thank you. Commissioner Massey? Commissioner Horn? Commissioner Samousis?
I have lots to report, and I apologize, but it's the, it's the way it is. The Adult Services Policy Council, and this council consists of well over 20 community health agencies and different nonprofits. It's a very large meeting. There's a lot of information, a lot of things going on. I don't like to miss that meeting. I've got a flyer here. So there's a Senior Health and Fitness Expo Saturday, February 23rd, 8 a.m. to noon. It is free to seniors 60 and over, but anyone over 18 may attend and register. There are free health screenings and fitness testing for seniors. It will be at the Allen Hancock College. I will give you the phone number. It's 922-6966, extension 3209 to call for registration. And there's also nutritional snacks available. It sounds like it's going to be a great program. In the absence of, and moving on to next issue, in the absence of a psychiatrist available to treat geriatric patients under the Medicare B, the following care model is being used with some success in long-term care and assisted living facilities. The primary care physician rules out any, this is kind of a protocol for that care that's been set up by Robin Lewis and Mary Malik. They're PhDs. There's also a pharmacist consultant, Dana Nelson from Health Plus Pharmacy. They've gotten together and tried to meet the unmet needs of the psychiatric care for geriatric patients. Rather than go through this, I'm going to give you, you can contact Dana Nelson at Health Plus Pharmacy or Robin Lewis at 756-2611 or Mary Malik at 541-2490. There is a data collection project that's an ongoing project. Members of the Adult Services Policy Council are engaging in community-based continuum of care. Marcia Bollinger, some of you I'm sure know Marcia, is working on it. The purpose of the project is to identify resources and find gaps of care within San Luis Obispo County and to coordinate that continuum of care to help bridge those gaps. It's kind of a lot of information in a short span. I'm trying to honor the lateness of the hour and our fatigue. But are there any questions from anybody, the commission or the public? Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your report. Commissioner Hetherington?
I attended the January 16th meeting of the Domestic Violence Task Force. And before I go on to that report, I received a letter from Dr. Jane Fong, who was on the commission previously. And during November, when we did the domestic violence panel, there was a statement made by one of the therapists that spoke about the mandated reporting that Dr. Fong was concerned because she thought that that was incorrect information. So I would like in the next month or two invite Dr. Fong and Bonita Sisla to come and discuss the proper reporting that therapists and doctors are required to do so that we have a clear and distinct idea of what that is. And I'll be happy to pass this information on to you. Domestic Violence Task Force met. They're dealing right now with gaps that exist within the courts. In a perfect world, they would have a court dedicated to nothing but domestic violence because we do have more than our share of domestic violence problems in the county. A new thing that came about was the Domestic Violence Child Death Review Team started meeting. Apparently, this has been a concept in the domestic violence circles that look at deaths that are a result of domestic violence, and I know that we all know that the Rivard case fit that scenario. So it's things like that that are looking at what happens in those scenarios and how they can maybe be prevented down the road. Jan Campbell, who's with the Department of Public Health, and Dr. Chasnoff, who had presented to this commission about perinatal exposure to substances such as drugs and alcohol, actually went up to Sacramento to present on that topic of perinatal exposure, and it was very well received. Apparently, there's going to be some pending legislation out of that that would require testing. I think that's about all. They continue to work with the Delta Project, Beth Robb from the Women's Shelter, and Lindsay going out to the high schools to educate students on what's appropriate in dating so that, you know, if somebody slapped around, they know that that's not acceptable behavior and what resources they have to use.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Graham?
No report.
Well, that ends the commissioner reports. Now, committee reports. Legislative? We didn't have a meeting.
We haven't met.
No.
No, so nothing from the legislative committee.
And community education?
We haven't met.
Okay. Budget committee hasn't met, and nominating chair is not here. So I present, and she sent no report. So that sort of gets through that. Now, prospective future items. We've talked about that we'll start to chew on the budget next month. And we also have the obesity report is going to come up next month. We talked about possibly having Parks and Recs talk to us about smart growth. Are there any other suggestions for next month? We could probably fit Dr. Fong in there, although the budget discussion might...
We'll have that off. I mean.
Okay. Okay. I think that could wait. Okay.
Lynn, yeah. Dr. Thomas had wanted to come to give a present a DVD.
Oh,
inequity.
Golly, I forgot that, yeah. Oh,
I don't know how long that'll take, but.
Yeah, that, exactly, and we will have that for sure next month. Gee, thank you for reminding me. I've been getting emails about it. And then we had, we were going to talk about what we were going to do for Public Health Week, but we're not going to do it tonight. So we probably really need to be thinking about it and talk about it at our next meeting, that being that Public Health Week is in April.
Yeah, I'll try and get a committee meeting together.
Okay.
And it might just be the budget that we're going to
talk about in Public Health Week?
Yeah.
Why not?
Novel idea.
All right. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. Just a little information on terms of the timeline when it would be most effective to engage in smart growth issues. As you know, our Board of Supervisors adopted some smart growth principles about 10 years ago. They haven't particularly been more than lip service up to the present time. However, they did direct that the Planning Commission begin working on implementations thereof, specific changes to our general plan. The Planning Commission will complete its suggestions, as I understand it, on February 28th. There will probably then be about 2 to 3 months before the package goes to the Board of Supervisors, during which time it goes to the local advisory committees. So if you want to advise the supervisors on the contents of that package, and particularly as it relates to health, exercise, and things like that, probably the best time for your review would be your April meeting. And it's not just an issue with Parks and Recreation. The Planning Department and Council of Governments also have people who are working on that. Just thought you'd want to know the timeline. There is something actually moving on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that information, so we can perhaps keep track of that and look forward to putting it on the April agenda along with the budget. Boy, what a lot of fun we're going to have the next couple of months. Yes, Commissioner Heatherington.
I think we're a year overdue on the pesticide use task force. So we might want to put that on there for a discussion item in the next few months, especially since the reports are coming out that eating organic keeps the organophosphates out of the children's urine samples.
Tell me what you mean by we're a year overdue. Was the task force to be resurrected every 3 years or something? Was that what it was?
Yeah, 3 years.
A new task force appointed? Was that the intention?
I'll have to pull the document and read it. I'll bring it to the next meeting and we can discuss.
Okay, let's put that on the agenda. We can,
it shouldn't take long.
We can briefly discuss that next month then. All right. If I see no other information coming forward, I'll entertain a motion for adjournment.
Moved.
Second.
I assume there's no objection. This meeting is adjourned.